Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. The first week of this Parliament has underlined that the Conservatives in the Liberal Party are determined to pursue their agenda in the second term of the Coalition Government. All but one Coalition backbench senators have signed up to a private member's bill to amend the controversial Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. Behind the scenes, meanwhile, Treasurer Scott Morrison is trying to get the Conservatives on side for the government's superannuation changes. Today we're joined by Erica Betts, a former leader of the government in the Senate, who was one of Tony Abbott's close backers. Senator Betts is a strong voice for the Conservatives in the Liberal Party. Erica Betts, there is this big push from you and other members of the Coalition backbench to amend the Racial Discrimination Act. Why do you feel this issue has taken on such urgency?
I'm not sure that urgency is necessarily the correct description, but there is an appetite to ensure that Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, or amending it, is part of the 45th Parliament's agenda. And so some of us were of the view that it should be put on the agenda, but having said that, budget repair, the Australian Building and Construction Commission, Registered Organisations Commission legislation, new terrorism laws, all those things clearly should take precedence, but we would hope that in the period of a three-year parliament we can chew gum and walk at the same time, and that there will be time set aside for what is a very minimalist amendment to the Racial Discrimination Act to remove the words offend and insult.
Just take us through what you would expect the timetable to be. Do you think it'll come up for debate this year, or will it be pushed to next year?
I would doubt it would come up this year, quite frankly. It will be introduced, and then I think it would make sense for it to go through the normal processes. It may well go to a Senate committee, things of that nature. So how it transpires, no timetable has been set, but we did want to put it up there on the agenda so it could be dealt with in due course, but fully mindful of the fact that the government has some pressing matters that do need to be dealt with.
Now, this bill, which has been advanced by your colleague Corey Bernardi, has widely been interpreted as a challenge to Malcolm Turnbull's agenda, even if the motivation of you and other colleagues isn't that. But isn't it likely, in fact, in the reality of politics, that it will undermine an already weakened Prime Minister? Or do you think that the issue is so important to those advancing it that that really is not a consideration?
I'm not sure that it's been widely interpreted as a challenge to the Prime Minister. The simple fact is that those that have signed up within the Senate includes people that voted for Malcolm Turnbull to be the leader and those that didn't vote for Malcolm Turnbull. So it does have, if you like, cross-leadership contender support in relation to this important fundamental principle, which lies at the very heart of Liberal Party beliefs, irrespective of describing yourself potentially as a smaller Liberal or a Conservative. It does have cross support within the broad church of the Liberal Party, and that is why we went to the election in 2013 with amending Section 18C as part of our policy, and within the grassroots of the Liberal Party and amongst the backbench there's still a very strong feeling.
When this came up in Tony Abbott's time, there was a big backlash from ethnic communities and from the Jewish community. Would you expect that we'll see that again?
No, I don't, because that which is being proposed by Senator Bernardi is a very minimalist approach. The amendments that were put forward by the Attorney General, George Brandis, went a lot further than simply removing the words offend and insult.
And was that a mistake? at the time?
Well, I'm not going to... I'll allow commentators to make that sort of an assessment, but what I do know is that there are people like Warren Mundine, a former national president of the ALP, that sees the good common sense in removing offend and insult, and there are people of a judicial office, etc., who see the benefit of this minimalist approach as being the right way to go. So to try to compare that which Senator Bernardi is putting up with that which the government put up previously would be to do this current proposal an injustice because it is so minimalist in comparative terms.
One major issue that's certain to come up soon is the question of the same-sex marriage plebiscite. Now, as we see the numbers evolving, it appears that'll go down in the Senate, at least unless the Labor Party does a U-turn on the rhetoric it's advanced. If it does go down, is that the end of the matter for this term?
I believe it should be, and I suspect it will be. The Australian people clearly have an entitlement to make a determination on whether or not we change the definition of a society's foundational institution. And so I think that is a very important matter. The Australian people should be allowed to decide, and one suspects the only people that are fearful of allowing the Australian people to decide such a fundamental issue are those that are concerned as to what the outcome might be. And indeed, Mr. Bill Shorten himself has now said, well, if it goes to a plebiscite, it might be defeated, as one of the reasons why he's against a plebiscite. Well, that indicates an arrogant disregard for the will of the Australian people to say, well, I'm against a plebiscite, not on principle, just because it might give me the wrong answer that I don't want. In other words, I don't want to hear what the Australian people have to say.
Do you think it would be defeated?
I hope it would be, and I believe that as people engage with it more and more and actually ask what will be the consequences, and we have seen that with the Safe Schools agenda and other things, I think people will see a reaction to it. It's all been one-way traffic at the moment, Michelle, with the media and ABC, SBS and tabloids and other media. It's all been one-way traffic. During a campaign, one suspects there would be a tightening up of that and there would be a requirement for equal space and time to be provided. And then with that situation, I think the Australian people would fully engage and make a different determination to that which is being suggested by the polls.
Do you think if there was a campaign, it should receive public money to put the yes and no case?
My own personal view is very strongly, yes, that should be the case, and both sides should be equally funded.
Now, on the question of superannuation, where you've been quite outspoken, do you think that a satisfactory compromise will emerge, and what are the minimum provisions of that compromise that you would find acceptable and some of your colleagues who are critical on this matter would find acceptable?
The superannuation issue is something that is currently being discussed within the coalition. Indeed, just this morning I had discussions with the Treasurer's office to further express my concerns. I've already done that personally with the Treasurer, now with a staff member who's across all the detail. And rather than broadcast exactly what I think should or shouldn't be done, the simple fact is there are good productive discussions taking place, and that requires flexibility, I think, on both sides. For myself, the one stumbling area is the issue of retrospectivity. One of the strong suits of the Liberal Party has always been we don't believe in retrospectivity, and in relation to the super sector in particular, the superannuation sector requires certainty, and any hint or whiff that a government might deal with things retrospectively creates a climate of uncertainty that I think will have ramifications for some time, and that is why, for myself at least, I see the retrospectivity aspect as the most concerning.
If the government stuck to retrospectivity, and I should note that there's debate about whether this is retrospective or not. The government says no. But if it does stick to that aspect, would you be willing to cross the floor?
Look, as a matter of principle, generally, yes, as a backbencher, I have crossed the floor in the past, and I assume once or twice in the future I might do so again, specifically in relation to superannuation. I am not going to say publicly and try to blackmail the Treasurer and government into a policy situation on the basis of myself or others threatening to cross the floor. Those sort of discussions should be held behind closed doors, and that is the way I believe that you breed the collegiality that is required for good government
policy.
But
you're obviously reserving your position because you're not saying, no, I wouldn't cross the floor.
Clearly, and every backbencher has the right to reserve their position on any matter, but the term reserving your position is what one says in the party room when one is about to cross the floor. And I'm not at that position as yet, and I hope I won't get there because I am confident that we'll be able to get a suitable compromise.
So you do believe that these talks are going in the right direction, that you will get enough?
Well, I am hopeful that there will be a good landing on this issue, which will ensure that we are able to move forward on the issue and put it behind us.
Some people have been rather surprised that coming from Tasmania, which is one of the less prosperous states, that you've taken such a strong stand on this issue, because not many of your constituents would be affected.
If you just see me in the capacity as a Tasmanian Liberal Senator, as a backbencher from Tasmania, fine. But as you said in your introduction, I was a former leader of the government in the Senate, and I've been literally inundated with emails, telephone calls, letters from all around Australia in relation to this matter. And indeed, there have been cabinet leaks published on the front page of The Australian indicating that there was deep discussion in Cabinet and division over this issue. Liberal Party branches and have moved motions expressing their concern. Can I tell you, in Tasmania, yes, it is an issue. Does it affect as many people directly? No, but one of those issues that hasn't been considered in this total discussion is if these changes are only going to affect 4% of superannuants, and that is how it has been sold, well, next time the government wants some more money, will it move to 5% or 10% of the superannuant population? And that is why it has created uncertainty, and that is why I personally am so concerned about the retrospectivity, because the feedback I got in Tasmania and from around Australia was, well, if you're willing to target 4%, next time you want a bit more money to redistribute the wealth in the country, why wouldn't you go for 5, 10 or 20% of the superannuation population?
So you see it as a slippery slope argument?
Yes, slippery slope, fundamental principle, and that is why I would hope that the retrospective aspect of these changes as a minimum can be, the provisions can as a minimum be grandfathered.
Let's talk a little more widely. A few years ago, the emphasis used to be on talking about the moderates taking up various issues in the Liberal Party, being dissidents on this or that. I think it's only in recent times that we've heard so much about the Conservatives in the Liberal Party. They seem to have come much more to the fore in the last little while. Do you think that's so? And what are the issues that fundamentally unite the Conservatives? And are they one wide group, as it were, collection, or the subgroups of Conservatives?
Oh, look, that's a very interesting question. There's no such thing as homogeneity amongst a group of parliamentarians. There are some that are very staunchly conservative but might have a differing view on whether Australia should become a republic. But on all other issues, they might be agreed. So to try to pigeonhole everybody into one category, I don't think is a useful exercise. But in general terms, the Liberal Party's success has been when the conservative view has been tempered by the moderates. And I still recall Prime Minister Howard coming into the party room from time to time saying, I know that this has not necessarily got majority support, but there's a group in the party room that believe we should do such and such. This is a compromise we've worked out. Please accept it. And we did it out of respect for the minority moderate view to keep everybody in the tent and to be able to move forward. And that is something that I think has served the Liberal Party exceptionally well, and I look forward to that continuing in the future.
So what are the core issues, say three or four core issues for the Conservatives at the moment, apart from 18C?
Look, the core issue is budget repair, and we believe that the government has a expenditure problem, not a revenue problem. So we do have to be tougher in relation to expenditure. I think that is a very important and fundamental issue. And then, of course, there are the issues of freedom of speech, of retrospectivity on superannuation and a few other things that clearly do unite us. Safe schools was another issue that concerns us greatly. And to his great credit, when the Prime Minister had it fully ventilated to him in the party room, it was he that said that there should be a review of the Safe Schools program. As it was, given that we were locked into a contract, he then, to his great credit, said, well, let's have a review, and it has now been substantially altered. So they're the sort of issues that do motivate the Conservative base of the Liberal Party.
To what extent are the Conservatives seeing Tony Abbott as one of their strong public voices?
Oh, clearly Tony Abbott is a strong voice for the Conservative sector within the Liberal Party, which is the large majority amongst the grassroots of the party, and he reflects and espouses the views and values of a lot of those people. And of course, you don't become Prime Minister in this game unless you have certain talents and capacities, and Tony Abbott clearly has those capacities.
Becoming leader twice has become rather a fashionable thing in parties on both sides. Do you think he could ever be leader again?
Oh, look, in politics, you can speculate on these things. John Howard said if he ever came back, it'd be Lazarus with, I think it was a quadruple bypass, and it happened. I've learned in politics not to speculate and never say never, which, of course, is a contradiction in terms.
Well, does that mean a qualified maybe?
Look, I'm not even going to say that, because I know how that will then be further reported by others. And Malcolm Turnbull has the support of the of the Liberal Party party room, and he enjoys my support.
To what extent is it an uneasy relationship between Malcolm Turnbull and the Conservative wing of the party, or do you think it's shaking down into something that is going to be more comfortable in this term?
At the end of the day, we are all united in the belief that Malcolm Turnbull is a lot better Prime Minister than Bill Shorten ever would be, that the Liberal National Party policies that we took to the last election will always serve the nation a lot better than that which was put up by the ALP. And therefore, it is within everybody's interests within the broad church of the coalition to ensure that we don't do anything that might compromise our capacity to be re-elected in 2019.
Now, as a former government leader in the Senate, you had a lot of negotiating duties in the last term under the Abbott leadership with the crossbench senators, the then crossbench senators. You're perhaps looking at it from a more relaxed vantage point at the moment, but how do you read the new crossbench?
Look, the new crossbench needs to be read, needs to be understood. And I had to learn whilst I was leader of the government in the Senate that you could take some senators through, let's say, half a dozen completely different policy areas, and they would get it straight away and say, agree with this, disagree with that. Others, after 20 minutes, you could see the concentration span was going, and I quickly learned you had to deal one issue at a time. And so for the first, I think, five fortnights of the sitting of the Parliament of the new Senate, we got carbon tax repeal through one fortnight. The next fortnight, it was the mining tax. The final fortnight, it was the temporary protection visas. And it took about a fortnight to get the full concentration of sufficient crossbench senators to be able to achieve the government's agenda on the Australian Building and Construction Commission legislation. Whilst I still was in the position, we got an equality of votes from the crossbench when Prime Minister Abbott and myself put it up, and then a few months later, when it was put up again, we actually lost it by two votes, so we actually went backwards in relation to the then crossbench. So what it shows you is it's very fluid, and what you need is the trust of the crossbench with those with whom they are dealing from the government, and that requires a lot of patience, a lot of consideration, and I trust that is what the current leadership is doing to assist the government to get its agenda through the Senate.
How do you think that industrial legislation, the ABCC and the registered organisations legislation, will go when it comes back?
I'm still hopeful that those pieces of legislation will get passed. I suspect there will potentially be the odd amendment, and indeed the basis on which I got an equality of votes in the Senate was that I had indicated to a number of the crossbenchers that if it got a second reading and we moved into the committee stage, the government would be willing to consider a number of the amendments that were being proposed, and then senators would make a final determination on the third reading as to whether the amendments were sufficiently satisfactory to allow them to vote for it. So I'm hopeful that negotiations will continue, and that the legislation which I spent so much of my personal time in helping to draft and develop...
And you were employment minister at the time.
Yes, I was the employment minister. So it was the policy we took to the 2013 election, and we promised the Australian people that within the first week of the new Parliament of 2013, we would put forward the ABCC and registered organisations legislation, and we had it ready to go for that very first week of the Parliament. A lot of work was done in fine-tuning and getting it right, and sadly we lost by an equality of votes in the Senate.
So you think it's fairly close? It could be fairly close to getting it through?
Yes. I believe that there is a... Look, the simple fact is the Hayden Royal Commission's findings are just so robust, and if I might say the findings so gross as to the activities on our building and construction sites, that unless you are somehow beholden to the CFMEU, that as we speak there are 100 of its officials before the courts around Australia. This is an organisation that needs to be brought back into line. We need the rule of law on our building and construction sites. It's blowing out costs by 20-30%, and it's something, as we as a government are trying to roll out a $50 billion infrastructure fund, we want value for money for the taxpayers' dollars. We want these projects to come in on time, on budget, and as a result, we do need the ABCC, and I think the crossbench will understand the imperative of that.
The government has been saying that they think this crossbench will be easier than the last. Now, this might be just cracking hardy, one suspects it is, but what's your view?
There are more people, more individuals, and therefore it will require, I personally think, more work, but you do have the benefit of three of them being with Nick Xenophon, four of them being with Pauline Hanson. And so it was somewhat easier when Palmer United, for example, were actually united, and you had the four
that
senators.
That didn't last long.
That it didn't. And all you had to do at the very beginning was convince Clive Palmer and his four senators would jump into line and do exactly what he said. Then one broke away, then another broke away, and so things developed. So, look, having said all that, I think it's still a work in progress, and we shall see how willing the crossbench are to negotiate with a government rather than just voting things down on the second reading.
To go back to Tasmania, you're obviously a power broker in the Liberals in that state. Do you think in retrospect that pushing Richard Colbeck down the ticket to what proved to be an unwinnable position was a mistake, because now you have no minister from Tasmania in the government, whereas he was a minister?
Well, look, one, I don't accept the term of being a power broker.
A man of influence.
In Tasmania. Secondly, the way that we do Liberal Party pre-selections is a very democratic system, and it is the Liberal Party membership that spoke and made a determination as to the order on the ticket and as to why the order was as it was, would be the combination of all the differing views but expressed in a ballot by all those Liberal Party members. So that is the aspect that you have to take into account. At the end of the day, I'm sure the Liberal Party membership made its decision on who they believed were of best value to serve the Liberal Party and the people of Tasmania. And it is always tragic when you see a colleague lose their seat, and regrettably Richard Colbeck lost his seat.
And do you think it matters a great deal that Tasmania doesn't have a front bencher?
Oh, look, it's one of those difficult issues, given that I used to be a minister and was elected by my colleagues to be leader of the opposition in the Senate. So in opposition, in the Senate, we elect our own leader. In government, the Prime Minister appoints. But I had the confidence of my colleagues to be elected when the vacancy occurred in 2009. I then was re-elected after the 2010 election, and chances are there's still some ministerial capacity left within myself. Senator David Bushby, who's the chief government whip in the Senate, clearly ministerial capacity as well. So I think it's a disappointment that the Prime Minister did not see fit to appoint somebody from Tasmania for the front bench when, if I might say, there is ministerial talent available from Tasmania.
Do you have hopes at some point of being able to get back onto the front bench?
I would like to be able to serve on the front bench again, but as I've said many a time, I got into politics to serve, not to succeed, in inverted commas. But of course, if you can be on the front bench, you can make a good and positive contribution. But having said that, I'm making a good and positive contribution from the backbench as well. And so it is the gift and the prerogative of the Prime Minister of the day to determine who serves on his front bench. But I think my ministerial career and record speaks for itself, and there is no impediment for my return, but it is up to the Prime Minister to determine.
Erica Betts, thank you for talking with us at the end of this first week of the new Senate. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back again soon with another interview. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.